You're listening to The Job, a talk show about design, music, business, culture, the web, and Portland, featuring interesting interviews with interesting people, and brought to you by Need More Designs. My name is Ray Briglib, and I'm joined today by Dan Manchester.
Hey, Ray.
Hi. Today is Monday, February 25th, 2013, and this is episode number 2.
We made it.
We're now a chronic condition.
We're now chronic?
That's awkward.
Oh, we're a chronic condition.
Yeah, I don't want to worry anyone out there.
We're a sequence.
Yes. So obviously, I'm going to jump right in today and talk about what's on the top of the news, and that is that I watched Cannonball Run this weekend. Have you seen that movie, Dan?
I have.
You have? Excellent, excellent. Have you seen the second one?
I believe so.
Okay.
Okay. There was, when I was in Bloomington, I lived in Bloomington for a while, and there was like a Burt Reynolds film festival once a year or something. It may have been an unofficial event, but
right.
Pretty sure the both Cannonball Runs made it in there.
That's great. Well, as part of, being an educated consumer, I of course had to spend most of the movie in Wikipedia, learning about its history, which I found fascinating. Did you know that there's a third movie in the series?
I did not know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. Strange, because it's called Speed Zone, and it stars none of the actors in the first two, is completely unwatchable, and it's basically like a SCTV cast movie. I read the cast, and it's like all the people from SCTV, and the premise of the movie is that all of the people from the first two movies got arrested before the race even starts, so a bunch of substitutes do the race. It's the worst possible plot. Even just hearing about it,
there's just a title card that says, "We needed to make a third movie."
Right, right. Contractually obligated.
So it's like Eugene Levy and...
Yes.
Who else?
And like maybe Dave Thomas.
Okay.
And like, what was that? Yeah, a bunch of, John Candy. Like,
oh, okay.
Like an all-star cast, but in the wrong movie. You know, like, what are they doing in a Cannonball Run movie? Yeah. So I was surprised because to me, this is a classic, right? But my tastes do not align with contemporary popular tastes, as I found on Rotten Tomatoes, which is a good reality check for any movie that you're really excited about, and then go and find that it gets about 30%. Harsh.
I feel like something like Cannonball Run, though, has a lot of, like, I was 8 when I saw this, and it was the greatest thing I ever saw. So you bring that sort of sentimental attachment to it. And seeing it now, it's hilarious. Like, it's even funnier because it's...
And it's bad
just
way.
Just ridiculous.
Well, really, I would say if you were going... If you had 3 minutes and you were going to watch the movie, I would say just watch the end credits, which probably are the most famous parts of the movie, because it was kind of like... That was among the first movies to do the bloopers at the end.
There's just like... Like Dom DeLuise and Burt Reynolds just laughing.
Just basically like, laughing uncontrollably in between takes. And apparently the director, Hal Needham, pioneered this thing because he started doing it with like Smokey and the Bandit a few years earlier and did it with both Cannonball Run movies, both legitimate Cannonball Run movies and some other ones. But have you seen Weatherman?
Mm-hmm.
Or the Anchorman, sorry, the Anchorman, the one with
Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you recall
the Weatherman with Nicolas Cage?
Right. No, I was thinking of the Anchorman.
Okay.
The end when they do the bloopers and they slip in one from Cannonball Run. Yes. So screw you, Rotten Tomatoes, and your 31%. And I love Roger Ebert, but he gave it a half star out of 4 possible stars. I think maybe he needs to revisit that review.
I feel like Ebert now would probably like see the benefit of it.
I think the movie was just before its time.
Well, he also seems like in the last few years since his medical conditions, mm-hmm. he seems to have been like much more forgiving of like, or like his tastes are broader. Mm. Like, and he sees the virtue in things that are just inherently silly. Like, that's really, Cannonball Run is just kind of silly.
Yeah.
Like,
sure.
That's,
sure.
That's its like entire reason to exist.
Right.
That and cars.
Right. Well, I mean, maybe the,
and yeah. cowboy hats.
This, that's Smokey and the Bandit. Yeah. To be fair, which I've never actually seen. So, I'll refrain from judging that. But I was going to say that, I think, well, what's funny is that I was actually 8 when that movie came out. So I am the target demographic for Cannonball Run. The movie was made for me. Like, it was the epitome of cool when I was a kid. Like, look at that guy with the mustache and his buddy, who apparently they were like best buds in real life too, which I just learned from Wikipedia, which I would not have guessed. But yeah, when you see them goofing around and the...
There are some great 90s SNL sketches where like Farley would play Dom DeLuise and Norm MacDonald would be Burt Reynolds, and it would just...
Oh, I have to dig some of those up for the show.
They're pretty great.
Oh, that is great. Yeah, he actually played Burt Reynolds really well.
Yeah.
It was, I think, Norm MacDonald's best work on Saturday Night Live was just playing Burt Reynolds on like the game show skits. Yeah, so comic gold. I never really, honestly, I don't think I've ever seen another movie that was not a Cannonball Run movie that Burt Reynolds was even in, but I mean, he has probably a long and storied career. He was considered for James Bond. Did you know that? After Sean Connery?
Burt Reynolds was?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
This was way before the mustache, to be fair. But because that would have been...
PM, pre-mustache.
But apparently he declined, saying it would be impossible for an American to play James Bond. This is according to Wikipedia, and this is where you start to question Wikipedia's references, because it would seem like you just say, yes, sure, I'll fake it. I don't know. I mean, if Dick Van Dyke can fake a Cockney accent for for Mary Poppins, I'm sure Burt Reynolds could have faked a... I'm joking, man. Of course, because that's famously like about the worst accent in movie history.
And this is actually timely, too. Cannonball Run was directed by Hal Needham, and he got like one of the Governor's Awards last night at the Oscars.
I think I tuned out before then.
Stuntman.
Really?
He revolutionized stunt work in film. And
yeah, well.
Cannonball Run, he actually did Cannonball Run, yeah. If I remember correctly.
Like, yes.
He did it in an ambulance, I think.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. A lot of the scenes from the movie were from him, or maybe it was a screenwriter.
He actually wrote the screenplay.
Oh, okay. Then yeah.
And directed it.
Yeah, apparently he did that stuff. A lot of the, like, did the ambulance. And apparently the ambulance in the movie was the one he used.
Oh, well. I know he wrote a memoir that came out a year or two ago. And he did. I didn't read it, but he did like tons of interviews. He was, every time I turned on the radio or tell, like, he was there.
Right.
And he talked about some of the stunts that he did, but also like that came up a lot, that he actually did the Cannonball Run like multiple times, I think.
I had always assumed that the movie was completely fictional. There was no such thing, but apparently there was a Cannonball Run, and it probably stopped soon after the movie because who's going to let that go on? And I still haven't seen Smokey and the Bandit, but I learned from just sort of browsing through Wikipedia and clicking on links that the whole premise of that movie is that Coors was not pasteurized, and so it had to be, and it was not legal west of the Mississippi or something.
Coors?
Or east of the Mississippi, yeah. So it was considered bootlegging, even in the 70s, to bring Coors beer. And the reason that the movie takes place in like 28 hours is because the Coors has to be transported before it warms up.
Brewed cold.
Is that there? Okay, well, there you go. Yeah, they should just put the Smokey and the Bandit poster right on there.
Oh, I just got fact-checked by Wikipedia. He did not write the screenplay for Cannonball Run. He wrote the screenplay for Smokey and the Bandit.
Okay.
Hal Needham.
I think I have to see that movie now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this coming weekend. Anyway, I found the bloopers in the show notes. So if you don't have time to watch the movie, and you know, at 31%, I don't blame you, but definitely watch the the bloopers, just if only for the cultural reference of, you know, it's kind of the birth of the movie Blooper. At least the infancy. Yeah. Do I want to talk about any web stuff? You know, I will say this about the podcast. This is sort of podcast meta stuff, but the podcast is not in iTunes yet. And it won't be until next week, at least, because I read Apple's guidelines and it says you should have 3 episodes or you might get rejected. So we're just sort of in this limbo.
They're sort of protecting themselves against ghost ships right from the jump.
They're not doing a great job, but you know, some precautions are better than none, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So far, so good. We're 2 episodes for 2 weeks. Very good. Yeah, so our interview on the podcast this week is with Tommy Habits, who is a Portland foodie who is involved with Bunk, just opened a Trigger restaurant, and has lots of interesting opinions about food. This was recorded last week, and I hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
I'm talking to Tommy Habits of Bunk Sandwiches and Bunk Bar and Trigger fame. Yeah, so welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ray. It's great to be here.
So for those of our listeners who don't know, what is Bunk? Tell me about Bunk.
Bunk is it's a sandwich shop. Just the same thing. It's a sandwich shop that I started with my partner Nick Wood. Almost like it's getting to be almost 5 years, so it's like 4.5 years ago. We started at Southeast Morrison between 6th and 7th, beautiful Portland, Oregon, and we opened up Bunk Bar like 2.5 years ago. And added a new partner, Matt Brown. And the three of us opened up another sandwich shop downtown and a Trigger restaurant and bar just this past fall. So Bunk is, you know, it's our, to start, it's our, I don't know.
Who business. Came up with the name Bunk?
I did.
Okay. What does it mean? What's the symbolism there? It
means not very good.
Oh, okay.
You didn't want to
start with low expectations, so you could.
Yeah. I definitely was sort of fascinated with that idea after years of being in. There's kind of a heady answer and a sort of a funny shorter answer. I don't know which one you want.
I want both.
I mean, partly it was named after the character of Bunk Moreland on The Wire, the TV show. The Wire. You know, so you know, it was at the time we were watching a lot of The Wire, and I just was my favorite character. And we incidentally have an autograph photo from Wendell Pierce, the actor who plays Bunk, to us that we have in our offices. But so partly that I had gone to school for English and had always just been fascinated with words and just especially sounds and I don't know, Bunk. I mean, it just was one of those things where it's like, I don't know, reality sandwiches had already been taken by Allen Ginsberg. So,
okay.
Okay. No, that was that. That's been geeky.
No, geeky. That's great.
It's just, you know, I mean, I don't know. I was just thinking of that idea though of the expectations because I don't know. I've been in cooking for so long, and there is so much expectation with when once you have any kind of accomplishment at all, or you know, or people have expectations of you, you know? So, right. With this sandwich shop, when we did it, my son was, I don't know, it was like 8 or 9 months old. I had left my job that I had had at Meriwether's restaurant, and Nick had also left too, and he was my sous chef there. And it's kind of, I was working on opening an Italian restaurant, mm-hmm. and it fell through, and I was really kind of desperate. And so we put together, we got some money from some friends and started Bunk, just the two of us. And at the time, I mean, it was just, we were just trying to do something that wasn't, we didn't feel was really there in Portland. I was worried about expectations. I didn't want people to, because we didn't want to do anything fine dining or mm-hmm. super fancy. I mean, that was kind of the main point. I was a little bit tired of that. You know, I had been doing that for a number of years. And
right. Was there a moment where, like, you felt I always assume when you're starting a restaurant like that, there's always a lot of like panic and sleepless nights. Did you go through that for a while, or maybe do you still go through that a little bit?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I've been going through that a little bit with Trigger.
Right.
Cause Trigger is a new concept, and we're working with a bunch of new people doing it. And it's going really well, but, I think about it a lot for sure. Obsess for yeah. sure about it. I mean, it's not quite where I want it to be in my mind. And I see that, which is all right. I mean, that's, I think a restaurant, like any endeavor, happens organically, and so there's only so much you can control about how it happens. You know, there's too many unknowns,
right? And people,
the big unknowns,
right? What is your vision for Trigger? Where is that?
That's the kind of thing is like, I'm not even totally sure. I mean, for me though, it's there is an idea of. I try to develop an idea of what my, for lack of a better word, my cuisine is, what I can offer that is personal to me, Tommy Habits, it's mm-hmm. like, which I think is ultimately what is needed of me. It's hard to explain, and I don't even know really what it is. I just know that for years I felt, under the guidance or under the hand of people who had taught me. And since Bunk has opened, I felt a real separation and that I'm doing my own thing. And I don't really think a lot about, how I used to. It's a hard thing to I don't know. Mm-hmm. Describe. Anyway, so I want it to be more Bunk. I want Trigger to be more Bunk. And I don't know really what that means exactly, but it just means me probably working a lot more.
More Bunk. is there like a... when you were doing Trigger, that's more of a... It seems like Bunk is more of kind of a sandwich shop. It's kind yeah. of the focus. And Trigger is more of, I feel like it's more something where you sit down and it's more of a dining experience than Bunk. Did you have like flashbacks from like Meriwether's or like any of that stuff?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I had anticipated the service being a lot more casual than it is. And it's just... It's kind of a hard thing to juggle. I mean, there's so many variables. There's so many factors. It's like, how much staff you can fit in there, like whether it makes sense. Can the bar handle making drinks and doing all these orders like they can at Bunk Bar?
Right.
It was decided that we needed table service. I had a whole idea, and I don't know, who knows, maybe someday this will institute this, but... I had this idea of because service is it's a thing I think about a lot. We kind of eliminated that a little bit with Bunk sandwiches, which is counter service. It's not table mm-hmm. service. It's hard. I feel like a lot of service is not like is not customer It's not made with the customer in mind. I mean, I think like, I mean, how often do you have the experience where you go to a restaurant and like when you need a server, they're nowhere around, or you're being bothered every like 5 minutes and checked in on, and you don't really want to be checked in on. And, and there's just, I feel like there's this kind, unless you have somebody who's, you know, really aware and observant as your server and connected, you know, can sense kind of when to go over to the table and when not, which is a real talent to be able to have. And so I don't know. I try to think along the lines of how it could be like service could be more in the hands of the customer. And I think that with counter service, I mean, when you need something, you can go to the counter, you can do this. So you're more in control of your dining experience. And so I think about that kind of stuff. And like, I had this idea with Traeger to have, you know, sort of like that Larry David idea of the, like ringing the bell, but like have like, right. have, my idea was to have a little light, like a call light, like an attendant light at the table. So when you needed something, you could just press it and then somebody would come over and check on you. And I got voted down by my partners.
Yeah. I had never been in a place that did that. That would be novel. Yeah.
I was inspired by a really pretty fancy place in London. I forgot the name of it. But they have a champagne button. They have a button at each table that says "more champagne, please," and then you press it, and the champagne cart comes around, which is fantastic.
That would be fantastic.
Every home should have one.
Have you ever waited tables yourself?
I have in. I've done more counter service, I would say, than table, than actually working as a waiter. Most of my experience has been in the back of the house, but I have been in lots of, I mean, when I was, you know, initially with Bunk, when I was behind the counter, I mean, a lot of times we were taking orders and, you know, you know, just kind of running food. And
so you're not from Portland, are you?
No.
How long were you here? Where are you from?
I'm from Fairfield, Connecticut.
Okay. Okay. So how long have you been in Portland? How long were you here before starting Bunk?
Before starting Bunk, I moved here in June of 2002.
Okay.
So just a little over 10 years I've been here.
Okay.
I was, I was like 6 years or so before I opened up Bunk. I had been done a lot of other stuff before then.
For example,
I'd say the majority of my time was spent with Ripe. I don't know if you're familiar with Ripe.
I'm not. What's Ripe?
Ripe Catering, and
okay,
it's Ripe was started by Michael Hebb and Naomi Pomeroy, and it was first a catering company, and then they started doing family suppers in their house. And then in a space just off of Albina and Interstate, there was a coffee shop there called the Gotham Building Coffee Shop, and then upstairs they did family suppers. When I first moved here, I actually had a hard time getting a job, even though having a pretty good resume. it was kind of funny. I was, you know, just one of those things where every time you go to a new place, you got to pay your dues sort of thing. So I was just taking line jobs. And then I worked at Genoa for a little while. And then, and my background had been in cooking, fine dining Italian. And so I started at Ripe, and was really excited because it was the most interesting thing to me kind of going on in the city at the time. So it was like 2002, 2003. You know, there were like the classic places, Paley's and Wildwood and Higgins and, you know, Genoa. But you know, there was not a whole lot going on. It wasn't certainly the restaurant, you know, Garden of Eden, it's been called by Time Magazine. So Ripe was doing the most interesting stuff, and there were a lot of really great cooks there that are still involved, you know, obviously still involved in Portland food scene. And we opened up Clark Lewis in 2004, and then in the Gotham Building Tavern in 2005, which I was a head chef, and unfortunately closed the year later. It was written about. I wish I had more material with me on it, but there's a lot of stories. There was a New York Times story about it, about the dissolution of RIPE. Mm. But we had
we'll put it in the show notes.
We had a lot of really great talented people, and obviously Naomi has gone on and is a super famous chef, and Beast is her restaurant. It's great. And then Gabe Rucker was my sous chef, and so was Jay Barwakowski. Gabe's at the Pigeon, and Jay's at the Woodsman. Was at the Clyde. So and a lot of really great people have came from that place.
Interesting. So you're starting Bunk, right? This is the thing that you're finally taking a shot at it.
Yes.
And you decide on sandwiches.
Yeah.
Was it you that conceived of all these sandwiches and sort of put them together?
Yeah, I'd say it was the majority. I did the majority of it. I mean, Nick and I worked together a little bit, and there's definitely some things that, I mean, were Nick's influence on the sandwiches, but I'd say the majority of the menu came from me.
So how did you decide what these sandwiches should be, or how you make a great sandwich that gets people excited? Like, what do you think about when you're putting that together?
I don't know. You think about all the aspects of it. I think, to me, it's, we'd either have kind of two approaches to sandwiches. It would either be taking something that was pretty classic and really making it exactly how we wanted to make it. And in that way, kind of put our own style to it. Or we took just a combination of things that we thought worked well together. Like thinking of it as like, say, composing a salad, uh-huh. And putting it on a sandwich. So it was just taking a bunch of stuff from our culinary backgrounds and really thinking about, the bread, the condiments, everything that goes into it. And I don't know, just getting obviously a little obsessive about it for sure.
Right. So were you like, or were you just coming in early and playing with ideas, or just working in the kitchen before the restaurant opened?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think at that point, I mean, I had worked, for a long time. I had, in different chef jobs, including like one of my first jobs was making sandwiches. I was making sandwiches at Poe restaurant. I was doing the lunch shift at his first restaurant, at Mario Batali's first restaurant. And I had to like do a lot of sandwiches. And so, I mean, that was kind of when I first started thinking about it, and getting creative, I guess, with sandwiches. And I'd say it was always a thing where like, I always was much more interested in sort of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like lowbrow food, because, fine dining is, to me, it's like, eventually it's like, it's really overhandled, over manipulated. And by the time you get it, there's occasions where it's like, it's awesome to go to a really nice restaurant and have fussed over food and be fussed over by an attentive wait staff. But, that's not how I like to spend most of my time, but,
right.
It's like to get a really good sandwich from someplace, or, a really good slice of pizza or great falafel, or I don't know. I just love that stuff. It's always, living in New York for a long time, I really came to appreciate that. And so, like when I worked for Mario, it was at the time that one of the waiters there, who actually became a partner in Lupa and has a bunch of restaurants now in New York, his name Jason Denton. He had left and opened up a place called Eno, which was like the diminutive in Italian, like a little thing, So and it was it's a sandwich shop, which has gotten a lot of notoriety. This was like 2000. He opened that in like, I would say like 97 or something like that. And he was doing like Italian panini panino, you know, and different little Italian sandwiches, and but they were really good, really flavorful, and got a lot of attention doing it. And that was part of, I mean, I'd say that was kind of an inspiration for me along the way, you know,
okay.
You know, just seeing people like being able to focus on something and try and do it well, you know, rather than, I mean, to me, you know, we had come from this, you know, restaurant where you had six menus. We had lunch and dinner and, you know, bar menu and, you know, this and that. And to the idea of being able to just do sandwiches was really awesome.
So kind of liberating.
You know, liberating, yeah.
So it was, I remember our office was a lot closer to your first location on Morrison, right?
Yes.
And I definitely remember the early buzz and the lines out the door. Like, what was like the secret to getting that going? Like, do you feel like
putting the register close to the door?
Was that the trick?
That was part of the thing.
So there's always a line, yeah. Third person in line is out in the rain. Yeah, well, that definitely seems to work because you drive. It's a busy street.
I don't know. I honestly, you know, we really, like I said, it was. We were. It was like it was kind of a bunk was a little bit of a desperate act when we first opened, and I really had no idea how the reception was going to be. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. In that neighborhood and at the time, you know, and that's the location. I wasn't sure of what was going to happen. It was really like, I just didn't want to take another chef job and I wanted to take a shot at doing our own thing. And so, you know, thankfully it worked out.
Can you remember a moment when you felt like, oh, you know, this is finally working? Like,
I don't know. I still kind of
not quite. Not, that moment hasn't happened yet.
Well, maybe really, that's good. Like, it was really there was. I mean, during like those first six to 8 months or so, it was like I never expected. I mean, when there had been, even though there had been a line every day, I still kind of expected one day for nobody to show up.
Right.
You know.
Right. Was there a moment where you're like, oh, we're screwed. There's like this restaurant that's doing the same thing three blocks away. Or was there ever any moment where you were like, someone's stolen our idea or stolen our thunder, or we're not going to be the darlings of the media anymore or something?
I don't know. I feel ultimately like what we do is unique enough that we have our place, you mm-hmm. know, and we have, thankfully, you know, a following of people who like our sandwiches, you know. So I think as long as we continue the quality of what we're doing and are, you know, I think that people will still like them. I try not to, I could, you know, go down that road and right. start getting dark, but I try not to, you know.
So was the bunk bar, was that the second location?
Yes.
Okay.
Wait. Yeah, we did open. We opened the bar and then we opened the job downtown. Yes.
So with the bar, well, it seems like a very different place when you walk in there. I mean, the menus are similar or the same, but it has a very different vibe and you have like shows there. What was the, how did you come up with that idea? How did that seem like the logical next step to just a little sandwich shop?
Well, it was kind of twofold. It was, we were doing, when we opened up the sandwich shop, we opened it up and we were there doing all the prep, everything, mm-hmm. you know, all, and so it was super tight. It was we were pushing, and it was kind of, I don't know if you remember those first days, it was kind of smoky in there, and we hadn't really put any kind of, we didn't, because we did everything with convection and with induction burner, we didn't have to do a proper hood system, which saved us a lot of money. Uh-huh. And so we then put in an exhaust fan and helped get some smoke out of there. And then we eventually, I bet we, you know, our thinking was, well, if we had a real kitchen to work out of, we could do all the prep there and then bring it over. And so with the bar, we were approached by Beam Development, who also, you know, just mile post buys. With that space, that corner space had been empty for a while. and Bakery Bar was there, and so it was they made us a really good offer on the space, and we had known Matt Brown for a long time. We had worked together actually at Merriweather's for a time period, and wanted to do a place where we could do shows and have it be a bar. And we initially also, this the other thing too with Bunk Sandwiches, initially wanted it to be a bar, but kind of it's an old building and we were pushing it really hard with the sandwiches during the day, and it also organically, like I said, developed into a daytime sandwich shop that wasn't a bar, and now actually we just put in a liquor license and are going to try 3 nights a week at the original sandwich shop doing a different concept called Dire Straits.
Interesting.
And okay. And have it be a bar actually at night, 3 nights a week. So, but we did want to have a bar. And so Bunk Bar came about from having the idea of being able to have a commissary kitchen and being able to partner with Matt Brown and do shows. And we wanted to do shows in kind of a non-traditional venue atmosphere. And we got Casey Burns to do the mural, and we're really excited about that being the backdrop for bands. And it kind of worked out. I mean, a couple of things we've gotten just a kick in the ass to do, and that was one of them. We were opening, we were trying to just get open with just the bar, and then had the offer to do a show with the band Waves, kind of right as, they had were breaking out and with their first record, and it was Jay Retard's band, and we were so excited, and so we got a friend of ours to build the stage in like a day, and we threw it together, and it was dark and dirty and kind of fun and super fun actually, but it was just something that pushed us, and all of a sudden we're like, oh yeah, we can do this, we can be a music venue, this is gonna work out maybe, and with the help of our friend Trevor Solomon doing the booking for the bigger bands. We've had some pretty amazing shows.
What's like your favorite show that you've had there
That's a tough one. I mean, actually one of the very first shows that we had there was the closing night for Music Fest Northwest, I guess 2010. And it was Jeff the Brotherhood. And it was just like, it's always kind of been the show that set the bar of performance. I mean, because it was just incredible. Like the energy, Jake, the one brother, was like up on the bar playing guitar. And it was just like, everybody was there. It was just super, it was just one of those great rock and roll shows. I don't know what happened. I don't know. Gosh, I don't know. The War on Drugs, that was one of my favorite. Deer Tick, Built to Spill, played a show there, a free show there a few months ago. That was pretty fun. It was kind of like a surprise free show.
So you're kind of a music fan. What are you listening to right now on your iPod, or what's your current jam?
I've been listening to a lot of French pop, like 50s, 60s French pop.
Like Serge Gainsbourg kind of stuff?
Yeah, Francoise Hardy.
Sure, okay.
Mainly because this one, I have this, I've been playing this one record for, I have a 7-month-old daughter, and it's like the thing that works to get her to sleep. So like I'll carry her in the baby Bjorn and play her the Francoise Hardy, and it's kind of sweet. So I mean but then it just started me listening to more, and it's one of those things where like I was had my headphones in and I was walking down Hawthorne, which usually can be an awful experience. Mm-hmm. And it was very pleasant because I was listening to 50s and 60s like pop music.
Just weave around the people on the sidewalk and you're fine.
And I don't know, I've been listening to a lot of, I got turned on to this this guy David Dondero, who is a really talented singer songwriter, kind of predates, but I think influential to like somebody like Bright Eyes maybe, or I don't know, I was trying to describe how I thought of his style, and it was like Jawbreaker meets what's his name, the guy from Texas, the Daniel Johnson.
Okay,
you know, really really good singer songwriter. Listening to a lot of like Pentangle, Burt Jansch, you know, like Fairport Convention.
Okay.
That wow. kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
Eclectic.
Well, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I
can see that, you know, you've got quite the record collection here too.
Is that what those are? Yeah. Yeah, we do. It's you know, it's our secret sauce here at the.
Yeah, we just put a turntable in our office, and I've got a bunch of records. I need to kind of get it a little more organized, but
yeah, it's same fun. Here.
It's nice though.
Yeah, it's kind of a mess right now, but you know,
it's a good distraction during the day.
It is.
I need more records that are kind of more like you can do work to, you know, because like a lot of. The records that I brought in, they like kind of demand your attention, you know, and I don't have I have one Mose Allison record that we kind of play a lot because you can kind of just put.
Yeah. A lot of times I'll just put on like jazz or have you ever listened to a Budos Band? Have you heard them?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good one.
I saw them at Mississippi Studio.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. One time they're that's a fun band to see.
They're going to be the theme music for the podcast.
Oh, nice.
I wrote to them to see if we could use one of their tracks.
Oh, cool.
I'm pretty excited.
Yeah. Gosh, just, I mean, it's so, like, that's the thing. I mean, it's hard. I was, you know, I played music when I was younger, and I've always been really into music, but I gotta say, I mean, living in Portland, Oregon, it's hard not to be a music fan. I mean, you've got great mm-hmm. record stores and then just, like, great people to talk to about music. I mean, it just seems like everybody. And then the shows, I mean, it's just like, you know. There's so much great, like
yeah.
so many great shows every single night. I mean, there were three shows this week that I wanted to go see. I'm hoping to make it to see the Sonics tonight, you know?
Oh, yeah. See, I'm so behind on that with the kids.
Well, I mean, you know, evidently the Sonics have never, ever played Port. I mean, they got back together recently. They did a show up in Seattle with Mudhoney, like a couple weeks ago. And are playing Portland, and supposedly it's for the first time. That's what I've heard, which is pretty amazing considering they've been, you know,
mm-hmm.
lived 2.5 hours for 50 years, 2.5 hours.
So other than your endeavors, do you have like a favorite meal in Portland right now?
Oof, that's a good question. Oof. It's hard to say. I'm kind of bad at that. I mean,
but that'd be a very favorite. But like, you know, is there like something that's kicked your ass in the past few weeks or something?
I've got to say, I mean, and this is terrible because I really shouldn't be eating this, but Loretta Jean's pies are incredible.
Oh, okay.
They're so good.
I have not had that yet, but I keep getting.
Yeah, like the cherry pie and the coconut cream pie. I don't know. Her crust is incredible. So I mean. She's doing great stuff, Kate McMillan there. Ava Jean's is really fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, I'm excited. I've only been there once and it's just been too busy to make it back. We had our anniversary dinner in November, my wife and I, at Imperial, and that was pretty incredible. Vitaly Billy's place downtown. But, you know, mostly like, we eat Pad Thai Kitchen, I think is delicious place.
Okay, yeah.
Pok Pok, you know,
yep.
More, I don't know. What do I eat? Where do I go? Big fan of Dew's Grill. Not too far away from here.
Right.
You?
Honestly, I've just been really into, this is going to sound funny, but like just getting simple like sandwiches and soups lately. Like,
yeah.
obviously I never miss a chance to go to a bunk, but like we're pretty close to, you know, Cheese Bar here. And
I was going to say, we just had lunch yesterday, Valentine's Day.
Oh, did you?
At Cheese Bar. And it was...
Dan was there yesterday. Did you see Dan? Did you recognize another gentleman?
I think I did, actually. I think you were at the table. I think you were... Were you with three other people?
I was.
Yeah, you were leaving right when we got there.
That's
my
funny.
Wife and I and our little girl. Like, we had a baby with us. Yeah, I saw you and I recognized you as soon as I walked in. That's kind of funny. Yeah.
Yeah,
Cheese Bar is Steve Jones is a good friend of mine. We joke. He jokes about all the media attention that I get. He calls me Tommy Habits, the man who invented food. So
he's coming in here on Tuesday for an interview too.
I call him the man who invented cheese. So.
Fair enough.
But he is awesome.
Yeah, he is awesome.
He is great.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. We ended up there last night because we didn't have a reservation anywhere, but suddenly it was like...
Nice.
We are going way off topic. But yeah, suddenly my mom was like, hey, you guys want to go out for a little dinner? I was like, well, not many places you can go without a reservation around here, so we'll just go to Steve's. And we got a table, and it was great. They were doing champagne tastings.
It's really nice. I mean, it's funny because there's definitely, I mean, there's a I'd say the majority of people cooking. I mean, there's really talented people in Portland who, you know, do like Steve. I mean, he has such incredible things to, you know, taste and try, and like has such a great beer and, you know, selection and things like that. It's like a really cool, you know, like curated, you know, mm-hmm. place. And there's lots of places like that. And what I do is not that, but it's still great that there are people who,
yeah.
I always feel like I'm lazy and they're not.
Like, I don't know.
It makes me like, you know, feel like I should be more on my game or something, you know, just,
yeah. Have you ever talked to, like Kim at Salt and Straw at all?
A little bit. Her? Yeah.
You guys should do a flavor with her. I don't know what you would do, but I think it'd be like a Tex-Mex ice cream. She's always like doing like, I mean, I suppose everyone does. You could probably do a donut with voodoo. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely, I mean, there's been a lot of crossover. And
yeah. I don't know. Is that unique to Portland, or is that something that people do in like a New York City?
I think in general, like it's really awesome to see. I mean, having been in you know, the food business for like 20 years now, I mean, and starting off, I mean, I started off working for the biggest celebrity chefs that there are, you know?
Right.
So it's like, I mean, I got that from the get-go. And so I'm definitely been jaded about, you know, food media and stuff, having been around it for so long that, and just food and trends, everything just trend and trend and trend, you know. But the thing that is happening that I see that makes me so excited is that people are starting to take themselves a little less seriously,
yeah.
You know, in food, and also like this whole generation of cooks and whatever, beer makers, wine makers, you know, cheese makers, everybody, all these artisans, or you know, they're all just down to work together and do stuff together. And, you know, there's just not a lot of ego as much as there was, which is great. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we've, you know, I'm, you know, we've talked a little bit with the guys from Breakside Brewery,
okay.
You know, about maybe doing, they've done some collaborations, you know, I have no idea what that would be, though.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to, you know?
Like I said, I mean, it's like, it's hard to really think about what it is that, like, I've been thinking about that a lot because I want to, like I said, I mean, with Trigger, I mean, I'm keep thinking about how can I make it more bunk like, you know, and it's just like, so what does that mean? I don't know.
Right.
You know? So
what is the essence of bunk?
I mean, is it grease? I don't know.
I have to go climb a mountain and meditate.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm doing that every morning.
That's true. One of these days it'll come to you. Yeah. The enlightenment.
It is. It's definitely meditative for sure.
But, cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks for your time.
Oh, no. Thank you.
Tommy Habits, everyone. There's no audience, so okay, cool.
Insert canned laughter. All right, thank you.
Okay, thanks for listening. We'll see you again next Tuesday on The Job.